This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
A rather shocking thing happened yesterday as I went to start my interview with the guest I was going to have for this week's Dreamland. I discovered that he had died last week of COVID, and therefore I had no interview. So to honor him, and I'm not going to say his name because of the family's need for privacy, of course, to honor him and to honor all of those who have lost their lives to this dreadful illness and are losing them in the United States at the rate of upwards of 3,000 people a day right now, I decided to go back into the Dreamland archive to a time before we started publishing the archive on unknowncountry.com to an interview that awakened me back in 2003 to the reality of afterlife communication. Prior to that, I knew there was an afterlife, and we had had many experiences already at our cabin with the dead showing up with their friends and with the visitors. And Annie had already understood that the visitor experience had something to do with the dead as well. But what we didn't understand was the intimacy of communication that was possible. A few hours ago this morning, I was on something called Pod 11 podcast, where I was talking about the afterlife revolution and Annie, and she showed up in the podcast, as I knew she would. And thinking about what happened with Dreamland, I thought, we are so far beyond where we were even a few years ago in our relationship between the living and the dead. The veil between the worlds is getting thinner. And for me, an understanding of that started with this interview with Betty Kovacs of the Camlach Institute so many years ago. So please join me in welcoming Betty Kovacs to the show once again, 17 years after this first aired. It is still filled with wisdom, deep reassurance, and joy. And if you're a Dreamland subscriber, be sure and join us tomorrow in the subscriber video room for a discussion with Sherilee Black, who was our guest last week on Dreamland, who is a proven psychokinetic and who is also a powerful afterlife communicator. We seem to be really circling this material on Dreamland in these past few weeks. It's amazing. And I guess maybe a lot of people who are passing on are here behind the scenes encouraging this show, which is very sensitive to this kind of thing, to go ahead and go a little deeper right now, when maybe a lot of folks need that. So listen up and enjoy this extraordinary interview from so long ago with Betty Kovacs. And for subscribers, we have a real treat. Back again to 2003, to the same show, Linda Moulton Howe appears and talks about a truly extraordinary crop circle. It's loads of fun and fascination, and a great reminder of how we used to think of that ongoing miracle in the fields, but it has been so stomped on and debunked and so overridden by tourist attractions and fakes that it's all kind of faded now. But just go back with me to 2003, when the truth and the life of it was still so very, very powerful.
Betty Kovacs has written a truly remarkable book. But before we start talking about the book, I want to tell you a little bit about who she is. She has received a PhD from the University of California at Irvine in the comparative literature and the Theory of Symbolic Language. She's taught in Europe and the United States. She is presently professor emerita at Pasadena City College in Pasadena. She has taught literature, writing, mythology, and symbolic language for over 25 years. She served on the board of the Jung Society in Claremont, California, as chair, program chair, and consultant. And Betty is also the author of a perfectly marvelous book called The Miracle of Death. To experience this essential truth is to experience the miracle of death. What essential truth is Betty talking about? There is nothing but life. Betty, why did you and how did you come to put that emblazon the cover of your book with that phrase, there is nothing but life?
Well, that's the experience that I had when everyone in my family was killed in three different automobile accidents. And that was really the major experience of my entire life, was to realize that death is not an end, but a transformation.
Tell us about this extraordinary tragedy that has brought you, I think, some extraordinary wisdom. Tell us what happened to this sequence of events.
Well, my mother was killed in 1990 as she crossed the street by an automobile. And my son, our only child, was killed when he was 20 years old in an accident, a car accident. He was in a trauma center in Pasadena for 13 days. And the synchronistic event is that he was taken off the life support system on exactly the same day and the same hour that my mother was killed 1 year before. And then 2 years later, my husband was killed in an accident in Hungary. But when our son was in the accident, my husband and I began to have extraordinary experiences. And my husband was a businessman, and while he was supportive of my investigation and exploration of these modes of experience, he himself had not really had that interest. But he did once our son was in the hospital, in the trauma center, and
yes,
and dying. And it's as though the whole universe opened up to him and to me. And,
Betty, when you say the whole universe, that's a very interesting phrase. In your definition, what does that really mean? What is the whole universe?
It seems that, you know, the human species has evolved to a point that each one of us is capable of experiencing the wholeness of the universe through ourselves. One might put it another way, that the universe has evolved in us to a point that it can experience its own wholeness within the human species. And we are not at the point that we're experiencing that all the time, but there are certain things that happen to us in life that sometimes force us into that, or jar us into that, or allow that to happen. And I think it happens to different people in many, many different ways, as you know. But I think it's the sense that there is no separation in the universe, that separation is a perception, and that when we can perceive the wholeness, it totally changes our whole worldview.
Is it a perception, Betty, or a choice?
Or a choice?
A choice. Do we make a choice to be and feel separate like this? Or is it simply a way of looking at things that's really less than we could do?
I think that circumstances, experiences that we have, and the way we form our culture, we all come together in a kind of consensus of what reality really is. And yet I think that there's always a longing in the human heart for more. We want more. There's something in us intuitively that knows that there is more than what our culture says is reality. And I think we long for it, but there are so many things in our culture that tries to pull us away from that longing, so that we sometimes accept or settle for other things until maybe we're just jarred out of it. So I think that probably in the deep mind of which we are all a part, there is that knowledge that there is more. But culturally, we sometimes make choices, and then we're born into those sort of solidified choices to live in a very limited form of reality. But I don't think we're happy in it. I think we are addicted. We become violent. We become insensitive. There's so many things that happen to us when our cultural choices hold us like in a prison.
Yes, I see. And it, now, why do we end up in this state, do you think?
In a kind of prison state?
Well, yeah, you're saying it's that the state that we are normally in is, maybe am I hearing you right? Or would you suggest it's not actually even a natural state or a state that we were intended to be in?
Well, you know, those are really hard questions because I think in our evolution, there are probably always choices all along the way. And I think other cultures have made other choices, and we've had various kinds of experiences and coming together with different groups, always where, as Teilhard de Chardin said, you know, we wouldn't evolve if the world weren't round because we're meeting each other, coming and going. But sometimes our experiences perhaps bring a lot of fear. And I think that the fear in ourselves and in other cultures as we come together, the fear of the unknown, the fear of difference, sometimes makes us cling to that which is familiar, even though it limits us and we don't like it and we know that it's not everything. I've had people say to me, you know, I don't even want to know about those things. I don't even want to think about them because as long as I'm feeling okay, this is all I want to deal with. But that has to be rooted in fear. And I think that many things happen to us in life that make us come face to face with that fear. And that fear can, if we confront it and walk through it, can open us up to much, much larger dimensions. But I don't know to say that it's, I think it's a limited state, and our natural state is to expand and to experience our own wholeness and our interconnectedness with everything in the universe.
I think that the loss of a child would be in fact the hardest thing that a person can experience, an adult can experience, especially the loss of a child who has just begun to live his life as your son had. And I was moved to tears, actually, by your descriptions of the struggle that you and your family went through during that dreadful time. But I was also moved and deeply moved by the gains that you made from it as a person and that you've been able to communicate. And I want to know where you feel your son is now.
Where he is now?
Mm-hmm, yes.
Well, you know, I think that we had the experience the day after his memorial, which was 1 week after he died, of our experiencing the return of his consciousness. And
tell us what that was like.
Well, it was so powerful, Whitley. I mean, it was the most extraordinary experience because, first of all, I'd like to just tell that experience that my husband had 2 weeks before Pishti's accident.
Of course.
And he was in his office, and he had a vision, an image of Pishti's car on the side of the freeway, and he saw Pishti's body superimposed on the car, and he knew Pishti was dead because it was two different dimensions, one superimposed on the other. And then he had the feeling, oh, that's right. It's almost time for you to do that. And then that horrified him. But he heard Pishti answer him and say, that's right, Dad. I will be out of the house for a little while. We had no idea what that meant. And Istvan, my husband, didn't even tell me that experience until after the accident because it was so horrible that he immediately became unconscious of it until the call came from the hospital. But later we understood what it meant, because after a week after his death, his consciousness was so fully present. And if I would ask myself, how did I know it was really his consciousness? It was so healing, and it was loving, and such a full consciousness connected to the universe. And it's as though in his return, he wanted us to remember why we were here, and help us to heal because of his death, but remember why he chose to die at that time. And it was related to what the earth is going through now. And so many of our experiences had to do with that. So his consciousness was fully present and loving and teaching and explaining and helping us to remember and reconnect. And then also, out of such a loving concern for the earth, he talked about this as being one of the most crucial transitions that the earth had ever gone through, and that there were beings, there was consciousness in spirit and in matter, working very, very hard to get us through this transition. And he tried to help us to remember what our role was in that. So at where he is now is, I had an experience with Ishvan after he died, and I was thinking to myself, oh God, Ishvan, why did you have to go too? And it was just a few seconds, and I could feel this tremendous joy. And he was saying to me, Kitchy, that's what he called me, I didn't go anywhere. I am everywhere, nowhere, and right here.
This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We'll be right back. You're listening to Betty Kovacs. It's a beautiful interview. Wise, wise words. Wise woman. Her book, The Miracle of Death, will lift your heart and your soul. There is nothing but life, it says on the cover. To experience this essential truth is to experience the miracle of death. Join Betty in experiencing the miracle of death. Pick up her book. Get it from the unknowncountry.com store. You can't find it in a better place than unknowncountry.com. Great prices, fast service, safe and secure online ordering. It's everything you could want in an online bookstore. Plus, it supports this radio program. The miracle of death. There is nothing but life. You know, listening to Betty, I know how true that is in my own heart and soul. It is true. It's quite wonderful and quite beautiful. Thank you, Betty. Get the book, The Miracle of Death. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We're talking to Betty Kovacs, author of The Miracle of Death. There is nothing but life. Betty, we hear on this program many ideas about the structure of the afterlife and recurrence and leaving the wheel of life and such things. What do these things, and this is just, I know it's a very general question, but based on your book, I think your answer is going to be terribly interesting. What do these things mean to you? What about reincarnation?
Well, I felt completely that there was no question about the fact that we are all totally and completely creative. Something we forget here, that we want to abandon our creativity and say that someone else created us and we have no role in this creative act. We all are creators and co-creators, so that we can do nothing but create. And so, of course, we're going to be creating many lives. We're in many places. And we can, you know, I love what scientists are discovering today about the quantum field, is that there's a sister saying there is no difference between spirit and matter. But we are constantly moving in and out, I think, of what we call spirit and matter. So, yes, I think that we are always creating. And my husband had many experiences of many, many lives, not the details, but just that he had been every race and every ethnic group. And he also had experienced that he and Pishti were one soul, and that sometimes they come in as one person and sometimes as two people. And so he saw faces showing them as one person and sometimes as two people. He had more experiences of that than I did, but I had no question about the radical creativity of every human being continuously.
And yet in chapter 5, I believe it is, yes, you start out with a very interesting quote. We need a worldview which shows how our deepest aspirations are related to the essential structure of the universe. And this suggests, and indeed you do suggest in this chapter and also in the chapter before, that there's a kind of a disconnect between us and that very aspiration.
Yes, and I think that is cultural. In our culture, Western culture, we do experience a disconnect. You know, we have the notion of whatever we intuit, the deepest aspirations within us are just something we need to get over. Bite the bullet, forget it, it's not this way. For instance, if we think of one of the deepest aspirations of the human soul, of the human being, it is to stay connected to those that we love most in the world, don't you think? I mean, the love is what we long for. We long to remain connected to it.
Yes, to something.
Yes, and yet our concept of death as the end of everything that we have ever loved, have ever worked for, have ever tried to create, is such a total disconnect. In mythology, we call this the myth of the straight line, and that is Western mythology. We're born into life, we come from nowhere, we live and we die and we go nowhere. It's out of nothingness into nothingness.
Yes, a terribly depressing and, in a way, enslaving vision.
Oh,
because it enslaves you. And you know, it's interesting that where this vision actually started was in Rome. It is the vision of the Roman upper class, and we forget that. We forget that the first consumer society was ancient Rome, but all you have to do is go to Italy to see where it ended up.
Yeah.
And we'll go in the same direction precisely, because this is a society we live in. Mm-hmm. Which is highly materialistic and based on the enslavement of others. And though anyone who thinks that this says and says, well, I work hard and I don't have slaves, all you have to do is get on a plane and go to Bangkok and go to some of those factories where they are building your shoes and or to Uruguay where they are making your shirts, and you will find slaves.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And
now, I want to get now to some of the words of your son. Can you pronounce his name for me? I'm very...
Pishti.
Pishti?
It's like S-H, uh-huh, Pishti.
Pishti. He said at one point during his life, I believe it was during his life, during the earth will be healed, it has called the jackal healers. It is dreaming its future to itself. And these, I was fascinated by the fact that so much ancient Egyptian symbolism, deities, appeared in your experience in various ways and very important ways. And so first I want you to explain to me who the jackal is and what exactly was being said here. And then we're going to talk a little bit more about the impact of Egyptian religious ideas on your life.
Yes. Well, I had a dream of the jackal before Pishti died, and I had taught mythology for years and years, but I had taught Old European and the Near Eastern complex, not Egyptian, but I was just getting ready to teach Egyptian, but I didn't know much about it. And when I woke up, I thought, is there a jackal? And, of course, I spent some time really doing research on it, but the symbol of the jackal for the ancient Egyptians is, of course, related to the function of the jackal in actual life. And the jackal takes its food, buries it, lets it rot to just the right point. He knows exactly the right point when she should dig that up and eat it. And, of course, in his body, he transforms this decayed, rotten, dead mass into life. And so it's a wonderful symbol of transforming death and negativity and darkness into light. And this was actually said by Pishti in a vision that I had the day after his memorial. And it was one of the most profound visions that I had. because I saw circling, just coming down to the earth, circling around it and chanting an incredibly powerful spiral of souls. And I knew that they had come to work with us, to get us through this incredibly difficult transition in which we must take in the negativity, the darkness, the limitedness that we have allowed to come into being on our planet, the decay, in other words, and within our own beings and transform it into light. And I was so ecstatic and so filled with joy at the love in the universe. And then I remembered how the world really is all over the world. And I became so incredibly sad. And that's when I heard Pishti say, the earth will be healed. It has called the jackal healers to itself. It has called the future to itself. And so on one level, I realized that these loving souls were ourselves from the future that were calling to us. And yet they were very real souls coming in to be born on the planet now who would take in this negativity and transform it into light. But they were also ourselves. So that was a kind of a mystery that could not be reduced to linear language. But the jackal really has returned over and over as a guide and as a symbol of the tremendous limitations that we have imposed upon ourselves, the negativity, the darkness that we haven't dealt with, and that we must now dig up in this time and transform within our own minds and being, our souls. And we are right on the edge. We're walking on the edge of extinction or transformation, and this is our work.
But isn't it going to be both? Isn't that really the message of the jackal, to bury the dead until they become carrion and then return them to life by consuming their rotted flesh?
Well, I experienced it as what we have been burying for generations and not looking at, the cover-up of everything, the cover-up of the larger dimensions of reality, or the terrible pain and sorrow and illness that we've experienced by limiting ourselves so much, that it's time now, that it's just the right degree of rottenness, and that it's time that we have to dig that up. We have to dig up everything that we have repressed or suppressed and denied and rejected. And I think it's coming back to us in such powerful ways that sometimes it just knocks us out, scares us to death. And it's now time for us to transform that limitedness into the expansiveness of who we are.
Do you think nature will play a role in this sense? In that same chapter, just a few sentences later, you go on to say, ask the question, was the earth calling to itself the death of our worldview? Were we as a culture or an entire planet ready to confront the mystery of death itself? And I wondered when I was reading those words whether or not you were talking about something in the physical, such as the possibility of an extinction event. And I reflect on this in the following way. Just yesterday, it was announced that an enormous ice sheet had broken off of the Arctic, of the polar ice cap. This ice is going to move down into the Northern Ocean and melt in the form of icebergs over the next few years, vastly increasing the amount of fresh water in that ocean and potentially destabilizing the North Atlantic current, leading to weather chaos. And this is only one of hundreds of things that are going wrong at the same time. We have in the United States an administration in power that almost seems to have come here by a kind of awful magic, which is devoted to the destruction not only of our ears and eyes and our scientific ability to see these things happening, but to any effort whatsoever to deflect us from the taking the path of extinction. In other words, it is man's or our death wish expressed as a political event.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with you completely.
So have we decided to die, Betty? Is that what this is about?
Well, you know, you state that very, very well. We are experiencing the consequences of all that we have denied and rejected.
Betty, we have to take a break.
Okay.
This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We'll be right back.
When should you subscribe to UnknownCountry.com? How about right now? Go to UnknownCountry.com and click on the subscribe tab on the masthead. We offer subscriptions either by credit card or PayPal, either automatic renewal or annual or longer subscriptions without auto-renew. Plus, it's easy to cancel if you wish. Do it right in your account.
And do we ever need you right now? And do you ever need us? The new UnknownCountry.com is beautiful. It is fully functional. The whole archive is working. It's full of amazing stuff. Plus, this is the only place like it in the world. Keep it going. It's up to you. Go to UnknownCountry.com. You know what you have to do. It's only a few pennies a day. It's not a big sacrifice, but it means an awful lot.
There are hundreds of charitable organizations in the world, but you have to have a sharp eye to be sure your money is going to where it's needed and not into the pockets of overpaid administrators. That's why Whitley Strieber and UnknownCountry.com support the Mercy Corps. It's non-sectarian, it's lean and efficient, and it goes everywhere on earth that people are in need. When you contribute, you can be sure that most of your dollar goes right to the homeless, the starving, and the desperate. Go to Unknown Country and click on the Mercy Corps Foundation ad on the left side of your homepage. A $10 gift can put food on a child's plate and shoes on his feet.
This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. Just before we left the air, Betty was beginning to answer my question. Do we have a death wish? Have we decided to die?
And, you know, Whitley, I think that there is that within us that has made a decision to die. And we're experiencing those consequences. But I think there is also within us a decision to live, but to live in a transformed state. And I think we will die to the old. And because of the visions that Istvan and I had, I am now hopeful and feel actually confident that we will make it. I don't know how much suffering we'll have to go through. I think very much because we have made choices that are out of the death wish. And yet, you know, I just last week was at a conference that was sponsored by the Noetic Sciences and Association for Global New Thought, and it was called Awakening a Global Vision, Collective Wisdom and Spiritual Activism. And I realized there that many of these people have had similar visions. And in almost every field, even of academic research, people are finding new ways. They are dreaming a new dream of life, but a new kind of life. And I think that we definitely will die to the old view. That's our death. But I think that we create best when we are in such extreme tension that it means we will either go as a species and take many of the species with us. 30,000 species become extinct, as you know, every year. And because of our presence on the planet, we will either die as a species or we will be transformed. And I feel that we are going to make the transformation.
Would it not be possible, in fact, that death is the transformation?
Well, you know, when I did my dissertation many years ago on Europe, always trying to dream this dream, because Europe has had holocausts throughout the centuries of its history, and each time it would not die to its old worldview, even though this new worldview of a more global vision was trying to be born in every creative period of Western history, it would not die. I think this time we have to die to it. Or become extinct.
Well, let's go back in history to the time of the Black Death, since we're talking about that, when 2 out of every 3 people in Europe and possibly in the whole world, we don't know for sure, died. 2 out of 3. The European culture, religion-based culture, based on the calling of the protection of God to man, didn't die then. It reestablished itself, and within a generation, it was back to essentially doing the same things it had done before and living in the same way. Now, does that not tell you, perhaps, that there is something about mankind as mankind is now that cannot transform?
I think that it takes almost an either-or situation. I think that, and that's where we are now, then we weren't at the place of extinction as we are today. I mean, we are really living in a discontinuous culture. We can't continue as we are now. It's simply there is an end to it. And probably we create best and in a time when there is no other possibility for us. That's a shame that it takes that, but it seems to be what it has taken to shake us loose. But as your own work indicates, there are enormous, anomalous experiences that are occurring that are shaking us. One reason I've loved your work is that you have talked about confronting that fear of the unknown and allowing it to be the transforming catalyst.
Well, because the darkness is filled with knowledge. The darkness is filled with knowledge. And that's why when I saw that there was something out in the dark around my house in the physical world, I went out into the dark to find it.
See.
And did, actually. It responded with the most, I think, what for me was the most magnificent experience I could possibly have. Years of intimate contact with all kinds of different levels of being and reality that aren't supposed to exist in the lexicon of the Western mind, but which exist all around us, and it was fabulous.
Exactly.
I started out with getting beat up something awful, but what a gift was actually on offer.
And that I love about your work.
I think you had the same thing happen to you, but on a much larger scale, because the darkness that beckoned to you, Betty, is the hardest thing I have almost ever heard anyone having to go through. The death of your mother, sudden and unexpected, the agonizing death of your son, the death of your husband.
I know.
The stripping of you of all of the ones you loved and then left alone.
Yes.
To sit and write books. What are you going to do? How do you live with this?
Because the other reality became conscious. You know, I never have felt alone. And I feared death as a child because my mother had lost her mother at 14, and she was so close to her. And her parents had been orphans. And I feared losing her because she carried my soul as a child. And then when I met my husband and I loved him so much, I always carried that fear that if he didn't get home on time, that maybe he was dead. And I think we all fear death. But that, I think, was the fear that I had to confront. And as I was so determined that I was not going to be destroyed by it, I was going to walk through it, as you, to go out in the woods that night. I was going to walk through that. I was going to experience everything that was there for me to experience. And, of course, the great gift was that my husband experienced so much. We had 2 years in which we were living in a joy at the same time that we were experiencing the greatest sorrow in our lives.
And then you lost him.
And then I lost him.
And at that point, Betty, I think I would have shriveled up and gone away. I don't know what would have happened to me. I am talking, I believe. I mean, I'm a tough nut. I have to admit that. I mean, anyone can see by what I did. But you're stronger. That's almost unimaginable strength to transform such tragedies the way you have into this luminous, amazing book.
Well, you know, we are all a part of that reality that is so much stronger than we imagine available to us. And I wouldn't have been able to had that reality not opened itself for us to experience, and it's available for all of us. I always believed that if one of them died, I would die, and I wouldn't even want to go on. But I was experiencing the interconnectedness and the creativity and the great passage that we're going through, the purpose and meaningfulness of life, and I experienced the continuation of their consciousness in a much larger perspective, and could experience their work still with the earth and the transition it's going through, so that on one level, in the physical level, I was without them. That, you know, you can't sit down and have a cup of coffee with them.
Yes.
But I felt them, and I think we are always called at death to walk through that gate of death and realize the much larger life that's on the other side of it. And I don't live in the same world. I think I live in both worlds, and I think that's our destiny. And you too, you know, you live in many dimensions because of your experience.
Yeah,
and
many.
Life is much richer.
Let me ask you this. Do you think that there was an element of premeditation or predestination in all of this? Did the group of you perhaps come into life together for the purpose of carrying this out and ultimately depositing this transcendent wisdom in the form of a little book?
Well, it seems as though I wouldn't call it predestination, but what you said second is that yes, it seemed to us, our experience was, both my husband's and mine, is that we had chosen, and that we are always, all of us, choosing. And yes, that what we need, one of the things we need to go through the transition that we're going through as a planet, is to know that, as Gandhi said, birth and death are not two different states, but they are two different aspects of the same state.
Yes.
And one time when Ishvan was experiencing Pishti, he was totally unconscious. He'd totally forgotten that he had died. And then Pishti realized it, and he said to him, "That's right, Dad. Remember, birth and death are events in time and space. There is nothing but life."
There was an incredible UFO wave going on back in 2007. Forgotten all about it? Well, we haven't on unknowncountry.com, and you can still explore it with one of the leading experts who was involved personally, Brian Vike. Listen to this.
A good friend of mine, he's in the UK, believe it or not, and of course I'm in Canada, and between the two of us, just two of us, we pulled in. Now this is going to be a rough one. I think I stopped it at 430. For reported sightings for Canada alone in 2007.
This is an excerpt from one of literally more than 1,000 different episodes of our various podcasts on unknowncountry.com. But how do you access them? We have a powerful search engine that enables you to access them by subject, but now also, when you go to the podcast drop-down menu, you will see at the bottom, Podcast Archive. This takes you to lists of all of our podcasts organized by year. And you can click on any year and browse through everything that's in that year for that podcast. This is a huge website, and we work more every day to make it accessible. For example, subscribers can now listen to the subscriber version of Dreamland on an app. There are a number of apps out there that will accommodate this, and subscribers will find more information about it in the subscriber section of unknowncountry.com on the Dreamland page. So for this and so much more, the time to subscribe to unknowncountry.com is right now. Go to unknowncountry.com and subscribe to this website. We need you. And I can assure you, you need us.
This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We're back. We're talking to Betty Kovacs, The Miracle of Death, a truly miraculous little book. Betty, I want to talk about the meditatio now and exactly what happened, and I guess still happens to you during these afternoon events. Tell us.
Yes. That was very funny with my husband, because he was always such a practical person, and his meditatios were sometimes sleep. But sometimes in the deep sleep, he had dreams that really took him to another dimension. And in fact, for both of us, there were this meditation or just listening to music. We were so split, right, wide open, that the universe was just available in ways that it had never been before. Something with his death that was so tragic and yet became so incredibly joyous in our connectedness that we had incredible experiences. Sometimes I would experience Pishti's presence as just sitting. I would be lying down listening to music, and I would feel his presence and just sitting by me, and I would be able to ask him any question, and he would tell me, and he said, "Now you remember that. Now you remember that." Or sometimes he would do other things to just shake us out of our worldview, like coming in dancing, and every cell was dancing. And that's when he had on the snake boots, and he said, "Dance life in snake boots," which means we have to constantly be transforming. We can't get stuck in a limited worldview. So while Ishwan and I were experiencing his death in the outer world and learning to deal with it, every evening and on weekends, we were together and meditated and experienced this. And it's just as though a whole world opened for Ishwan, and he felt that he had to keep that door closed until Pishti died. He couldn't allow that side of him to develop. That's what he felt after Pishti's death. And Pishti had said to him, "Yes, because we are one soul, had you developed that side of yourself, you and she might not have been able to conceive me," which was a very strange thing to us at the time. It seems less strange now. But
much less strange, because it seems then what you are saying is that there was a certain amount of preparation, if not pre-planning.
Yes. Yes, and that goes back to the, instead of predestination, I think we are making choices all of the time, but time is in such a different place. I mean, our understanding of time has to become so different. Just as Pishti dreamed of his death when he was almost 12 years old and dreamed of his being in a trauma center and then being on the other side and completing the circle of 10, that I think that those choices are made, but it isn't, you know, we're probably making them in the now, because in the universe there's only now, and we can probably pick them up here in our linear time at any time. I think it's a kind of complicated, it's complicated to speak in linear language about different dimensions of time, though.
Things that aren't linear, it is complicated.
Yes, But I didn't feel that it was predestination, but I did feel that we made these choices creatively, and Ishwan experienced us playing a similar game for similar reasons in parallel worlds. And Pishti said to him, "That's right, Dad, sometimes you die and I stay. Sometimes you stay and I go. It depends upon the particular circumstances, the way they work out in time and space." So it seems that our work did have to do with death.
Mm. I have to ask you, what about now? What about other people coming into your life? Another husband, perhaps?
Well, you know, I've thought, of course, of all of those things. I have, and this I am so deeply and profoundly grateful for, I have such a wonderful, loving community of friends in Pasadena and here in Claremont. And you know, as a teacher, there were always young people in my life, and recently I did a book signing at Romans in Pasadena, and students came back who were in my class in the 60s. So it was, that part is wonderful. As far as another man in my life, I think that we must always live life totally open, welcoming of love from from wherever it might come. Love is always a gift. It's not anything that I long for or that I even have an imagination for now, but I'm open to total creativity, I would say that. And I try to, if I see myself getting stuck and not being open, then I try to tell myself, no, we have to be open to all possibilities in life, and then we make choices.
And then... Would,
mm-hmm. But so, I mean, if something comes into your life, then at that moment you can choose.
And you would let it, just sort of let it happen then?
I hope I would, yes. Because I think that by creating a closed framework, we limit our realities. We have no idea what can come. I mean, I try to practice being open to all realities. Having realized that I had lived, as I say in the book, in a square inch and had called it reality. And that's what I had been trained to live in my culture. And the irony of it is that I always longed from the deepest part of myself for something more. I studied only because I was looking for something more. And that led me to study religions and then to the roots of religions and mythology and symbolic language, which is the language of the soul, the middle brain. And that was my longing, always longing for it. And yet, in the academic world especially, I got hung up, you might say, caught, imprisoned in a fear that the universe was empty. And that's what I had to confront. That's a horrible fear, especially when everyone you love is dead. If you think and fear the universe is empty and experience it that way, then one is destroyed. But I was, thank God, able to walk through that fear and realize the complete fullness and creativity and joy in the universe.
You wrote, as I begin this 10th and last chapter, it is also the 10th year since István and I received that unexpected call that brought the jarring end of what we had considered normal life. Anubis, God of the void, the all, had appeared on the horizon and beckoned us to follow him into the mystery of death. This plunge into eternity had curved the straight line of our mythological imagination into the wholeness of the circle. We had experienced the miracle of death. This chapter begins in a remarkable way with a quote, "Then gradually people all over the earth begin to dance the round dance to heal the raped heart." Tell us, what are you saying here?
Well, you know, I'd earlier said that in Western culture, we had lived a belief system in the straight line of from nothingness to nothingness. And when you take the birth and death at two ends of that line and bring them together into a circle, then you form eternity, that death does become birth. And that's, of course, the mystery of death, when you realize it really is a birth into a transformed state, that there is no way that something dies and disappears. And that old belief system of the Western world, that limited worldview, is killing us. It rapes
it is killing
the heart.
Us. It makes us into materialists, and it turns us into little caterpillars who eat the world instead of butterflies who fly among the flowers.
But
let me ask you this. If we don't die, what is left? I'm speaking from a material standpoint. What is a spirit?
If we don't die?
Yeah, since you're saying we don't die.
Oh, I see. If we don't die,
yeah.
Yes.
What is a spirit?
Well, I think that it's consciousness. It's the essence of who we are.
But
the soul
where does it live? After death, what's left?
Well, I think that the essence of
is
who we are...
Is it an electromagnetic field, or what?
Well, I think maybe we could say the quantum field, but that's what mystics have always called the ground of being, and we are all rooted to that, and we all carry the totality of evolution within us, that over 13 billion years of creativity is within all of us, and we take that, wherever we are, whether we are in what we call matter or spirit, our essence is, you know, I love in the Old Testament when God says, I am that I am. It's that isness, that beingness, that field or ground of being always exists. And we are always creating. You know, I tell that one experience that I had of when I was in Peru, of my dead body being taken very quickly by spirits to the,
yes,
to the great mountain, Huayna Picchu. And I thought, oh, because the legend there is the great masters are there, and if you enter Huayna Picchu, they'll tell you the secrets. Well, when I got right up to the mountain, there was no entry. And then suddenly everything opened up, and I laughed and laughed and laughed to realize I was the mountain, I was the spirits, I was the masters, I was the earth, that there was no differentiation. And that's why I said earlier that separation is always a matter of perception. But perception can kill us if it's limited. And in that moment, I knew who I was and who we all are, that whether we're in this dimension or the other dimension or any dimension, we are creators. But then suddenly I thought, oh, my God, but I can't create a world. And the most incredible thing happened. A voice said to me, you just did create a world in which you cannot create. We can do nothing but create. And my realization of that is that that's what we've done in the Western world. We have created a world in which we are so limited, and we call it the reality that is given us, and it isn't.
What do you do when you're lonely?
Well, you know, I almost never feel alone. I think the great gift of these experiences is that we are all embedded in the universe.
Yes.
And, of course, what I want to do is always to find ways, more means of experiencing it, you know. But, of course, we need each other, and I do have friends, and they are important, you know, to love another. That's a thing that, you know, you realize when you lose a mother or a child or a husband that you can't touch them anymore. You can't, you know, it's that wonderful gift of being in the physical world that is,
yes,
such a wonderful gift, and how sacred it is. And I am so grateful to understand a little bit of how sacred that is now. And so I miss that, yes, but I guess I don't really ever feel deeply lonely anymore.
Betty Kovacs, what a marvelous time it has been talking with you. You've lost everything and have gained so much more. A truly wise woman in our world, author of The Miracle of Death. What a remarkable thing to come out of such tragedy. I think Gary Schwartz was quite right when he said also that your journey is supported by the latest research on precognitive dreams and survival of consciousness after death. We haven't gone into, folks, some of the remarkable stories of precognition and afterlife experience or communication that are in this book. It is a very powerful book. This is something we're all going to experience and all going to face. And Betty, thank you so much for sharing your journey with us in this marvelously enriching way.
I thank you, Whitley.
This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. Linda Moulton Howe will come next.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Strieber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Strieber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.